Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Do your best C.S. Lewis.
I allowed myself to prepare for confirmation, be confirmed, and make my first communion all in total disbelief, acting a part, eating and drinking my own condemnation, he says. I knew I was acting a lie. I simply could not tell my father my real views.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome along to today's show, and a bit of a treat for you today. Not our usual debate format, but some great conversations on the forthcoming C.S. Lewis movie, The Most Reluctant Convert. My first guest will be Max McLean, who plays the title role, and then towards the end of the show, the director Norman Stone will be joining me. If you want more about Unbelievable, go to our show webpage. It includes our newsletter, links to our YouTube channel, where you can watch today's show, and ways to support us too. We'll even send you our ebook, Why You Can Believe, as a thank you if you're able to support. Links there also to our new Confident Christianity course too. That's all available at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and I'm excited to say that plans are afoot for a long overdue bespoke website for all things Unbelievable, hoping to reveal a sort of holding page for that before the end of the year, the full site in all of its glory next year. Right now though, time to talk about C.S. Lewis with a man who spent a long time playing him. Max, welcome along. It's so good to have you with me. Let me do a little introduction to you first of all. You are the founder and artistic director of the Fellowship of Performing Arts, I think based out in New York, but known all over the world for your productions, including, of course, many based on the writings and life of C.S. Lewis. And a new movie had just been released, The Most Reluctant Convert. We're going to be talking about that today, and I believe being shown across the USA in theatres and things like that. So welcome along to the show, Max.
Thank you, Justin. I think this is the second time you've had me, I believe.
I think it is. I think we last connected, I think, around the time that you were in London doing a performance of the Screwtape Letters, which I attended with my family, and we really enjoyed it. It was, I got a feeling it was something like Christmas 2017, maybe?
16, I think. 16 or 15, somewhere there. Yeah. It's been a while.
Okay, that long ago. There you go. I mean, And that alone sort of shows the way that you've been involved for so long in doing plays, productions around the writings and life of C.S. Lewis. Tell us, Max, before we get into this, the new movie, did you grow up kind of with a love of acting? Was that something that was there right from the beginning?
No. You know, I'm an immigrant. I came to America via the Statue of Liberty when I was 4 years old. In fact, we came in at the West Side Passenger Terminal, which happens to be about a 10-minute walk from where I currently live in Midtown Manhattan. So the first thing I had to do was master the English language. I've been working on it ever since. My first involvement in theater was really in college, and that was to get over a fear of public speaking, sociophobia. So that's how I got into the theater.
There you go. So it was actually to to overcome the nerves of speaking in public, and now it's more or less all you do for a living.
It's all I do. Yeah.
Tell us about your Christian journey, though. Did that go hand in hand with getting into acting and drama?
Well, that's very interesting because I started acting in my senior year of college, about 22 years old, and then I had an adult conversion experience about a year later at 23. And it was meeting a woman who, if I wanted to be with her on Sunday, I would have to attend church. A very odd experience. But what was not odd was, I mean, you know, the worship experience was odd, except for some reason the Lord's Prayer that had a haunting effect because I knew it. Mm. And so that had an effect. And then met some of her friends who I graduated from college with a history degree. And one of her friends mentioned that, you know, Jesus was a person in history, just like Lincoln, just like George Washington. Well, that was news to me because I thought Jesus was fairy tales. And for some reason, that little twist, you know, opened my mind to want to read the gospel. I've tried to read it in the past, but didn't get anywhere. The person of Jesus just overwhelmed me. And so my conversion came right around that time.
Wow. That would be an interesting film in itself, I imagine. But you've obviously devoted so much of your life in a way to telling the story of C.S. Lewis and obviously producing his works as well. When do you first remember bumping into the works of C.S. Lewis, Max?
Well, this person who I was attracted to, Sharon, who later became my wife, I had the conversion experience. I'd read the New Testament. I had the year prior read Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, which had a huge impact on me. I don't know why, but I mean, it just hit me in a very deep place. And now I do know why, because it's probably the greatest Christian novel ever written. But I had no experience with C.S. Lewis. So she thought, oh, I must be, you know, I would be into him. So she gave me a copy of Surprised by Joy. I was 23 years old. I read it from cover to cover, and I must say, I don't think I understood a word of it. it went by me like a freight train. But I, you know, I knew I was up against a massive intellect. And I said, I don't think this is it. And I didn't get it. And he says, well, try this one. And it was the Screwtape Letters. And from page one, you know, the man in the British gets on the bus at the British Museum. I said, oh, I know this guy. This guy is, man, this guy has been in my life, you know, and so, you know, Lewis's transparency, his, you know, he deals with sin at the greed, at the spite level. You know? And so, you know, not, you know, he's not after, you know, other people's sins, crimes of humanity and all that. He's like, you know, what did you do today that was so hurtful, yeah, spiteful and yeah, mean? And I said, okay, yeah, yeah. So that was my first introduction.
I was going to say, in that sense, you went straight to the meat, in the sense that a lot of people, obviously, their first introduction to Lewis is the Narnia stories. I mean, had you come across those at that point?
No, I hadn't even heard of them. So right. So I was never much attracted to, at least I don't recall attracted to fantasy very much. So anyway, yeah.
There you go. So. As your own faith developed, you obviously eventually founded the Fellowship of Performing Arts. What took you on that journey? Did you feel that there was a need to see the Christian faith given this kind of a way of expression, you know, through the dramatic arts and so on?
Yeah, it was sort of a backdoor thing because, you know, I did not grow up in the evangelical church, so I didn't get the memo that Christians weren't supposed to be actors. And yet, you know, I went to drama school in London, and I went to the National Theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Theatre, to the Old Vic, the Royal Court, on an absolutely regular basis, and my imagination was constantly being engaged, and I also, you know, as a new Christian, I was really sensitive to Christian themes, you know, in all of these works. And so the idea just popped into my head, you know, why aren't Christians doing this? And they were. I mean, there was a group called Upstream that I think was doing really good work back then, in late 70s, but not in America, at least not that I was aware of. And so the idea of fellowship for performing arts emerged, you know. Why not use the skills and techniques developed in the theater to present these this worldview? And so that was the germ of the idea, and I was able to get people to support the idea, and that's where fellowship began.
Yeah, and I think, frankly, one of the reasons it has been so successful and has gone around the world, Max, is because you do it well, and that's not true of all art produced under the Christian banner, because sometimes, sadly, it can just mimic the world and do a fairly substandard job of it, can't it? Whereas we used to have, it appears, you know, Christian art simply was the art of its time. And so Michelangelo, anyone was, you know, it was sublime.
Yeah.
What happened? How do we kind of get back, if you like, to art that really is creative, engaging, aesthetically beautiful, that really honors God in that sense?
Well, I one of the things is that, you know, it all begins with the church, and the church in the main doesn't produce artists, or at least it didn't. It's starting to now. I mean, it certainly produces musicians. Every time I watch The Voice or America's Got Talent, or, you know, you're seeing all of these people coming out of the church. So musically, that's still the case. We produce some of the best. But theatrically, there's been such a suspicious element to it, and probably rightfully so. I mean, you probably know that you know, actors were not given burial rites. You know, Augustine had horrible things to say about the theater. So that has a long tradition for that. And then of course the way it was redeemed was for some kind of evangelistic purpose, agenda-driven purpose. Now, mind you, all art has an agenda. There's nothing. It's not agenda free. But the question is how do you articulate that agenda? And so what Fellowship was trying to do was we wanted to our mission was produce theater from a Christian worldview meant to engage a diverse audience. So it's a simple mission. And in order to do that, you had to select the right material. What material would at least gain the respect, you know, of the audience, and then you'd have to execute at the highest levels that your budgets will allow, so you can play the greater venues around the country. Because we made it a point not to play churches. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but we wanted to play in the marketplace of ideas where the other places were. And so to get the production values up there was really, really important. Mm. And then, of course, we asked people to help us do it. And so that's why we're a fellowship for performing arts. It's a fellowship of people who believe art and theater from a Christian worldview can engage the imagination and influence culture.
Mm. Well, let's talk about The Most Reluctant Convert. So I think you've produced a number of different productions that are related to Lewis. When did you decide to actually produce a stage play that would reflect his own conversion journey, experience?
It began after adapting Screwtape Letters and adapting The Great Divorce from the page to the stage. Both of those works have to do with spiritual warfare, you know, temptation, kind of sins of commission and resisting the conscience, resisting the Holy Spirit, sins of omission. And in both cases, Lewis was so transparent about it. And so he was using his own personal experience, his own emotional autobiography. And so with that in mind, you know, we've done the two. I said, well, Lewis is always going back to his conversion. The time where he was just resisting fighting. So that got me back to Surprised by Joy. And what I ended up doing was I didn't know, not that I knew Screwtape would be, or even The Great Divorce. I didn't think either one of those, they weren't obviously theatrical material, but they did, you know, if you worked at it and found the theatrical arc to it, you could get there. So I did try to do the same thing with Surprised by Joy. And actually, that was actually simpler because, you know, it's a change story. You know, once I was this, I was that. And what I ended up doing, and, you know, people say that, you know, for playwrights, if you really want to understand a playwright, you actually copy it out and try to figure out why he went this way instead of this way. So I actually did that with Surprised by Joy and got really inside it. And from that, I was able to craft, after many, many, many attempts and lots of development. In 2016, we did a stage production of it that ran in New York for 15 weeks and plays at colleges and universities all over the country. We had a really good run with it. Of course, with the pandemic, it just shut down. But that was the history of Most Reluctant Convert.
How many people before the pandemic shut it down? How many people had it played to by that point?
I would say roughly 100,000 people had seen it in one way. We had some 200 different performers, but more than that, around the country. And then, you know, I mean, the pandemic just shut us down. We had two shows on tour. Most Reluctant Con was doing around the colleges, and then we had a show in New York. We had a modern adaptation of Paradise Lost, and all of that went from, you know, going 100 miles an hour to zero just like that. It was like you hit a wall.
Well, we know the devastating effect that the pandemic has had on the theater and performing arts world, and you were no different in that sense. And many of those venues and companies only really just starting to claw their way back now. But I mean, you pivoted, you know, quite quickly, actually, because it was this film idea, converting the stage play into a film, was that something you already had on the agenda, or was that something that was a kind of fruit of the lockdown experience?
Well, Norman and I, Norman Stone, who directed the piece, and you probably should say a little word about him, but he's a terrific filmmaker, has 40 years experience with the BBC and many others, a couple of Emmy Awards, a couple of BAFTA Awards. He and I met at an arts conference about 10 years ago, and we hit it off right away. We have a similar vision about what we want to do in film and art. And about in the fall of 19, I called him and said, you know, this stage play is doing really well. Would you consider having a conversation about making a film of it? And he said, well, let me see the script. So I sent him the script. He loved the script. And so we started having conversations. And in January of 2020, you know, we made an agreement that he would do the kind of research that would be able to get us to a treatment that we could put a budget behind and decide to film it. But in my idea, that was going to be, you know, 2022, 23 project. It was not anything immediate. And plus, we just had so many things going on. Sure. And then with the shutdown, you know, that, you know, of course, everybody thought it was going to be short term. At least we did. You know, I don't know if you remember 15 days to flatten the curve. And I thought, what am I going to do for the next 2 weeks? You know, you know, and then all of a sudden it just got longer and longer. So sometime, and Norman and I were having regular conversations over Zoom and Skype. You know, he lives in Scotland, I live in New York. I think sometime in June, he said, if, you know, the British film industry is going to open back up in August under very strict conditions, and he could get a very good crew together and get a very good cast because nobody had worked since March. And if we prepare to act now. And I said, well, I asked him to confirm all that and then make sure the locations we needed were available. And I would go to the board and see if I could get the funding to put it in the can, right? Mm. You know, and we worry about post-production and distribution later, but just get it in the can. We got the rights from C.S. Lewis Estate shortly thereafter, have a good relationship with them. And I remember on August 31st of 2020, I got on a plane as big as Air Force One with with fewer people on it. from Newark to Heathrow, went into quarantine for 2 weeks, began filming mid-September, finished filming mid-October, and came back, and here we are a year later.
Yeah, wow. Well, I remember the Facebook updates. We're friends on Facebook, Max, and obviously you sort of, it was great to see the way it unfolded. It looked terribly exciting when I was seeing you in various parts of Oxford filming, and then I realized Michael Ward, who's a mutual friend of ours, was he's a brilliant C.S. Lewis scholar but also has a penchant for a bit of acting himself, and was playing the part of the Church of England vicar, and so it all looked great fun, and I'm just stunned that it came together so quickly. Though it's almost miraculous, these things never come together that quickly normally.
Well, part of it, Norman works extraordinarily fast, and you know, because he sees everything in his head, you know, he sees the pictures, and we already had the script was already you know, such, because it's been fine-tuned from all these theatrical productions, so those two things were there. And then, you know, we had to take one of the things we had to do was take COVID tests like all the time, and they were just they were just so, gosh, it was so tedious. And anyway, but any one of those tests, I mean, you know, we had 17 actors, 190 extras, so if an extra got a positive test, it probably wouldn't have done much. But if I got a positive test, or Norman, or if the cinematographer, it would have shut us down for weeks, and you know, and we would have just sat there and waited. And I don't, you know, I don't know what would have happened, because shortly thereafter, like in mid-October, like by the end of November, there was a second wave came and they shut down filming again. So we probably wouldn't have been able to finish the film. Yeah. So it certainly has a providential element running right through it.
Tell us about the film then, because obviously shooting a film is very different to putting on a stage play, which is essentially a one-man stage play to a large degree. This obviously involves multiple characters and so on. You're still very much Lewis, but the older Lewis narrating. And I've had the pleasure of seeing the film and I really loved it. Fantastic film. It was just so good. And it strikes me that the script itself draws from all kinds of points. I was like, ooh, now this is Surprised by Joy. And ooh, now this is from this other. So tell us about how the script itself came together, what that was like then turning that into something that was obviously shot for a movie instead.
Well, the script emerged primarily from Surprised by Joy. But it also had many other sources. The problem of pain, like the opening chapter, when I was an atheist. So you get this empirical view of the experience of being on this planet alone and just looking out, you know, the universe is dark, cold, empty space. I mean, that's our empirical experience. So if you just use that, that's what you see. And so we start from that Lewis's empiricism, and you know, and he comes to it, and then you get he begins to play with the statement, I think, of brilliant poetic prose: either there's no God behind the universe, a God indifferent to good and evil, or worse, an evil God. That was Lewis's empirical view of the universe, and that's kind of the starting place of the play. So you get that, Lewis giving you, this is where I was mentally at a point in time when I began to change. And then he starts talking about what contributed to that. Well, my mother died when I was 9 of cancer. I prayed, nothing happened. You know, prayer doesn't work. It was his conclusion. And then he talks about his religious education, where there's 1,001 false religions, and ours is completely true. And he says, on what grounds? You know, so because he was a very smart boy, and he was kind of a lout. He was, you know, a big personality. His father was a huge personality. In addition to his mother passing of cancer, he had a terrible relationship with his father, who Lewis regrets to the end of his life. He was involved in the butchery of World War I. So how could he come to any kind of other conclusion? You know, it says there's a wonderful line that when he returned to Oxford, they read the minutes of their last meeting from 1914. He returned in 1919. They read the minutes of his last meeting from 1914. And he said, you know, he said, never had I considered how big of a waste yes. the whole experience was. And somebody asked him, it says, were you much frightened in France, meaning in the trenches? And he said, all the time, but I never sank so low as to pray.
Yeah. There's just, I mean, so much material to draw on, isn't there? And the way you weave it together in the film is just wonderful. What is it like for you when you step into those shoes, when you step into that personality, when you step into the costume? I mean, just when you started quoting, you were immediately turning on the C.S. Lewis just now. Do you feel like you yourself convert from Max McLean into something like C.S. Lewis?
Well, it's really a lot of fun to be that smart for 90 minutes. I mean, to be able to say those words, to just get into that skin. I mean, obviously I respect him immensely. And so, you know, it's almost like, the desire to be greater than you are, on so many levels. I mean, not the least of which, you know, he took, the idea of right and wrong so seriously. You know, because he came to the conclusion that, you know, if the universe is just biochemistry and physics, then why should I be concerned about any kind of moral imperative? And yet he found that he was. And so he wanted to, you know, track that. I would say that where he helps me the most is his honesty coming from this dead empiricism, which really leads nowhere. And yet intellectually he thought that was justified, then going to this other place because there was something drawing him there. Some of it was the apologetic, I suppose, the dialectic of desire, the dialectic of reason. Those two things joined together were probably the biggest drivers to his conversion. And of course, that led him to just God, where he said, my religion was like that of the Jews. Yes. So he couldn't come to terms with Christ until a little bit later.
Well, we'll talk about that in the next segment of the show, because as has been shared in people like Alistair McGrath and others who've written extensively on Lewis, that there was a multiple stages, as it were, to his conversion. We're talking about Lewis on Unbelievable today, bit of a special today. I'm joined by Max McLean. He's the founder and artistic director of the Fellowship of Performing Arts and stars in and has been part of the screenplay and everything else, obviously, for this new film, The Most Reluctant Convert, directed by Norman Stone. If you want to find out more about it, cslewismovie.com. That's the best place to find out how you can watch it at your earliest convenience. It is showing in theatres across the US during November. But we'll be back in just a moment.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's show. The new C.S. Lewis movie releases across the U.S. on a limited one-day theatrical release on November the 3rd. You may have to wait longer to see it elsewhere in the world. The place to go to be updated is cslewismovie.com. Here's just a snippet from the movie trailer.
I never cared for my name, Clive Staples. The world came to know me as C.S. Lewis. Perhaps you've read my books. The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is the most famous, but there's one story that's not so well known. It's my story. And who better to tell it than me?
Welcome back to the second part of today's show. A bit of a special today, looking at C.S. Lewis, particularly in light of the release of the new film, The Most Reluctant Convert. I've been really excited ever since seeing this popping up in my feed since last year as Max and his team were filming in Oxford. And then to see it now being released is wonderful. I've had a chance to see a preview. And if you want to find out more about it yourself, cslewismovie.com is the place to go. The link is with today's show to find out more. Max McLean, who is founder of the Fellowship of Performing Arts and obviously stars in the movie as the older C.S. Lewis, is my guest on Unbelievable today. Max, tell us about the two other actors, key actors, because obviously this traces the journey through Lewis's life. You're there as sort of introducing, and then it's a beautiful way in which you weave yourself into the scenes with the other Lewis's. It's very, very well done. But tell us about these other actors who, I think that the younger of which has gone on to become quite a name recently, haven't they?
Yes. So the structure of the film is we begin to live in Lewis's memories. Lewis is probably his age would be around 52, right around 1950. The reason we select 1950 is because it's pre-Narnia and it's pre-Joy Davidman. Both of those things are yet to come. But Lewis had already begun writing his autobiography, and he looks back on the time between 1908, when his mother died of cancer when he was nine, to 1931, when he took communion for the first time since he was a child at Holy Trinity Church in Headington, just outside Oxford, Christmas in 1931. He was 32 years old. So that's the period. And so when he looks back, we cast two actors, introducing a marvelous boy actor to play the boy Lewis, named Eddie Ray Martin, who's just so charming and kind of a bit of an urchin. He looks to me like what Lewis would look like at 9 years old. And of course, the struggles with his father come through, and the devastation of the loss of his mother comes through. Then by the time the story gets to about 16 years old, the actor changes to a young Lewis, the Lewis that goes off to war, the Lewis that becomes the young scholar at Oxford. And that's played by Nicholas Ralph, who's making a name for himself in Britain and in America as James Herriot in All Creatures Great and Small. And he's just marvelous as the young Lewis. And so the play, the film, goes back and forth and of course, we cast the mother, the father. We have the great Nock, we have Tolkien, Dyson, and Barfield are all part of the
yeah,
movie.
That's the lovely thing. Lots of these characters who were so influential on Lewis are brought to life as well in the course of the film. You mentioned there his first communion, and I'd forgotten this from having obviously read it at some point in his memoirs and so on, but he regarded this as a terrible thing that he did to have gone through confirmation and communion without actually having believed any of it. I mean, just describe what Lewis says about this and why he felt so guilty afterwards about this.
Well, he said it was the worst act of his life. Let me see if I can actually find the words. The worst act of his life was.
Yes, do your best, C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, he said.
We'll get a taster here.
He says, I allowed myself to prepare for confirmation, be confirmed, and make my first communion all in total disbelief, acting a part, eating and drinking my own condemnation, he says. I knew I was acting a lie. I simply could not tell my father my real views. Not that he would have stormed. Let's talk the whole thing over, he would have said. But the thread would have been lost at once. Here again, he's talking about his relationship with his father. His arguments, I would not have valued a straw. The beauty of the authorized version, the Christian tradition. Oh, it was all sentiment. Nor could I, it was all sentiment. And if I tried to make my exact points clear, there would have been thunder from him and a thin, peevish rattle from me. Nor could the whole subject ever have been dropped.
It's a great moment in the film. I really enjoyed that. What did you learn in the process of both creating the stage play and obviously doing the film about Lewis that perhaps you hadn't quite realized in you know, before, having obviously been a fan of Lewis for some time up to that point?
Well, the thing I think everybody discovers with Lewis is you never get to the bottom of him. You know, that's why people keep coming back to him. It's a bottomless pit, mostly because his intellect and his emotion are so tied together. That's why it makes it really work theatrically. It all combines. So it's not like he's just a head, you know, where so many academics are, or he's just this, you know, just all emotion where, you know, he brings it all together. And I think, and he's so transparent. You know, I've always been kind of struggling because he was a very private person that just shouted from the rooftops his most private thoughts. You know?
It's a strange kind of contradiction in terms, isn't it? But I know exactly what you mean. He wasn't an extrovert exactly, but he was incredibly transparent when it came to his actual writing and very honest, you know, about his shortcomings and everything else. Let's talk about the conversion itself, because obviously that's at the center of this film. Mm-hmm. And what many people don't realize is that this was a multi-stage journey that Lewis went on. Do you want to just describe what those stages were and how you bring them out in the film?
Yeah, it's a little tough. Lewis when he describes it in Pilgrim's Regress, he said it was, you know, he thought that his conversion was from atheism to idealism to pantheism to theism. He says he thought that it was a conversion a lot of people went through. He says nobody goes through it like that. He says it was like he compared it to somebody's travels through the Gobi Desert as being as obvious to the general public as the rail from Oxford to London. You know, and so he starts with atheism and then idealism, and that sort of happens with Barfield. You know, it's like, are your moral and aesthetic, is your moral and aesthetics valid, meaningful? He says they are. Is logic, does logic and deduction lead to indisputable truth? He says it does. Mm. So Barfield says then, well, your materialism has to be abandoned. Because otherwise it's all... your materialism says that you have to trust your mind, and you can't. It's all biochemistry and physics, Lewis was shocked by that, because his reasoning was it's all natural selection, random mutation, allowing humans to have a reproductive advantage over other species.
You kind of represent this in the film as this conversation that happens in Lewis's rooms between himself and Barfield. But what it was, you know, I recently reread Miracles by Lewis, and it was all, you know, chiming with that, obviously. So, but are you saying that really it was Barfield who first kind of put those ideas in his head, you know, that he was the originator of
at least challenged him? I think they were already there. But they challenged him because, you know, he didn't want to have anything to do with the supernatural. He had something called the new look, which was to just be, you know, just the straight and narrow. Don't do anything that's out there in the theological world, the supernatural world. Because he also had a taste for the occult, which was something that I didn't know. So he's dabbling, and I guess Barfield allowed him to ground it into reality. I think he makes a very famous statement in Surprised by Joy that, he said, that my first step was to abandon the absurd notion that the universe is an arbitrary alternative to nothingness. That was the first step. And that led him to an idealism that God is out there. If Hamlet and Shakespeare could ever meet, it would have to be Shakespeare's doing. In Lewis's original experience, Shakespeare's way out there and Hamlet's down here. They never meet. And he says, but what if Shakespeare wrote himself into the play? Mm. And that's where it became more theistic for him. Theistic in the sense of the God of the Bible. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. At one sense, he says, my God was like the God of the Jews. And he couldn't come to terms with Jesus until much, much later, and particularly through that walk with Alistair.
Well, let's get this in place then, because obviously the title of the film and the stage play comes from a very well-known passage in Lewis's, I think it is Surprised by Joy, where he talks about one particular night in his rooms in Oxford when he's in turmoil and he feels like God has been chasing him down until finally he relents and kneels and prays. At that point, the most dejected and reluctant convert in the whole of England. Now, what is he actually at that point converting to? Because it becomes apparent, I think, in the film that he starts to go to church at that point. He starts to sort of take on, if you like, wants to do something to
fly his flag, he says.
Yeah, fly his flag. But it doesn't feel like he's kind of embraced at that point full-bodied Christianity. Is that fair to say?
No, but what's very interesting is he embraces full-bodied theism. You know, that God is real, that God is God, you know, that he owes his allegiance to the God who made the universe. He just can't. And so to you and I, who grew up in the Christian tradition, we immediately apply a Christian interpretation of that. But he said that I knew nothing of the incarnation. The God to whom I served was not human. That's, you know, but it was, but he did not think the universe was arbitrary. He thought the universe was purposeful and he owed his allegiance to his creator. So in a certain sense, he gives tremendous support to theism. And I think we sort of discount that a little too much.
Yes. It's just so interesting, though, because there's these various moments. There's one thing where he's on a bus and he says, by the time I walked off the bus, you know, I'd decided in my mind that God existed. And then you've got this sort of more kind of personal...
That's the motorcycle ride.
Yeah, that's the motorcycle ride. But all of these various experiences and it's shot so very well. There is this famous walk again on is it in the grounds of Magdalen College, isn't it? With a very another very very well known writer, J.R.R. Tolkien. So describe what this is, where you find this in Lewis's own memoirs, and how it's represented in the film. But what the big point of this particular conversation was?
Well, first of all, we have to kind of set up the fact that this is J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, you know, two people on Mount Olympus, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, just regular everyday colleagues at Oxford in 1931, you know, hadn't written anything of any import at that time. Who knew what they were going to be? They're having a conversation that pretty much revolutionized a spiritual map of the world from that point on. The key issue was that Lewis was sort of admitted to Tolkien that I have with great reluctance come to believe in God, but not Christianity, he said. And That's a key point, because he couldn't understand how the life and death of someone else, whoever he was 2,000 years ago, could help him or anyone else here and now. He just didn't get it. Didn't understand the Christian revelation at all. And Tolkien takes a completely different path that really is quite extraordinary. He uses Lewis's, you know, they shared a common interest in mythology. He says, and so Tolkien asks him, when you meet a god that sacrifices himself in a pagan story, and they're all over the place in pagan history, Balder, Dionysus, Osiris, all over the place, Tolkien reminds him, you like it very much and are mysteriously moved by it, provided you meet it anywhere except the Gospels. And then he makes the point out, the story of Christ is a myth, working on us in the same way as other myths, with one tremendous difference. It really happened. It's the myth in which all the other myths point. It's the true myth behind all the myths. And for some reason, you know, I mentioned earlier about when that person said, you know, Jesus was person just like Lincoln, just like George Washington. That was a kind of moment for Lewis, because it made him read the Bible differently, read the Gospels differently. Because in the past, he was probably reading it as a textbook, you know, looking for prescription, you know. But here, he was reading the story of a hero, the archetypal hero, where he saw the, you know, as Jordan Peterson would say, the worst possible thing happened to the best possible person. Mm-hmm. And it changed him, because now he had to come to terms with Jesus. And in all this, you know, all of his apologetics about Jesus then come to light after that moment.
It's a really interesting one, because obviously up to that point, it had been a very intellectual journey, arguably. At this point, it feels like his imagination steps into that worldview, and suddenly a penny drops, and it's as though, yes, this is what I was waiting for. This is why I, because we all know that Lewis, you know, was a huge fan, got so much joy out of the mythologies and everything that he was, you know, a scholar of. And I think it was this point that he realized it's real. That it's not just I'm enjoying fantasy, it's that the fantasy becomes real in Jesus. There's this sort of touch point with reality where I don't have to be an atheist materialist over here while simply enjoying this other world that somehow bears no relation to it. No, these two worlds have come together. And that's that. I think you do that so well in the book. I feel a bit like, you know, Tolkien had his own movie out not so long ago, and that really underplayed, frankly, his Catholic faith. I feel like we need a Norman Stone version of the Tolkien story.
Of that,
as well.
Yeah, that could happen.
Who knows? Look, why does Lewis remain so phenomenally influential and indeed popular, especially in the USA? I mean, he's obviously still a great name here in the UK, but if you know, it's often out of the US actually that I'm hearing the most. You know, over 50 years on from his death, people are still wanting to write film, talk about Lewis. What's the enduring appeal there, Max?
You know, I've been thinking about this more recently, in many ways, listening to some of your programs, because I think Lewis is a bridge from the postmodern world that we're all steeped in. You know, that we're educated in, which basically says here we have to live for the here and now, and there's very little concern about this other world. And Lewis is always talking about this other world, and he makes that other world so compelling. Part of it is, you know, he didn't have a formal theological education, so he comes to theology from a literary perspective. He read everything from the Greeks to the moderns. He had a steel trap mind that could recall everything he said. He had this extraordinary ability to translate that into magnificent prose and speech. You know, I think arguably he's one of the greatest writers who ever lived. You know, I mean, certainly in terms of the kind of writing, kind of reading that I've done, you know, and I've read all of Shakespeare. I've read a lot of Dostoevsky. I've read less and less of moderns because they just don't do anything for me anymore. But I just find that he allows me to go places supernaturally, imaginatively, theologically, that I don't get to any other way.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, I work in the world of apologetics and we try and find creative ways of bringing it across. But Lewis was had that supreme ability to use the imagination and creativity through the written word to do that, whether it was Screwtape or Narnia or the Space Trilogy or whatever it was. He seemed to understand what actually was the winning combination, if you will, of bringing the intellect and the imagination together. I think that's what you've done with this film as well, if I dare to say that. I think it's a wonderful way in which you're in that tradition. But sadly, apologetics as a whole tends to remain very one-sided. It's almost entirely an intellectual pursuit. And too often it's divorced from the arts, from the imagination. I mean, do you feel like that's going to change? Do you feel like we're heading in the right direction? Because I feel like we need another C.S. Lewis, or we all need to become a little bit more like C.S. Lewis.
Well, I do think that's true. But there was a quote, I think it was Austin Farrar, and I'm going to paraphrase it from memory. But he essentially says, see if I can find it, that... yeah, in fact, it's if you can bear with me, it's probably worth finding because it comes at a. I'm writing a new play called Further Up, Further In. It's going to be developed next year, and he tells a wonderful story about. He says, "I do suffer from an incurable intellectualism." I love that. He says. Of course, the direct evangelical appeal, come to Jesus, is still remarkably effective. He says, I've seen it done. I love that. Seen it done. He says, I can't do it, but those who can ought to do with all their might. And he tells a story about a vicar who once asked him to make such an appeal at an RAF meeting during the war. And he said to him, I wish I could do the heart stuff. You do the heart stuff. I'll do the head stuff. But in this, I was quoting Austin Ferrer. He says, it's not that rational arguments create belief. He says, I don't believe that. He says, on the other hand, I do think the lack of it destroys conviction. And this is the key point. What is proved may not be embraced, but what no one defends is soon abandoned. I was really struck by that because, you know, we do get a little bit discouraged, you know, by the apologetic enterprise, but we can't stop it. Because I think this last point, and this is something Lewis believed, but what no one defends is soon abandoned. And that's what's happened at the American University. It's not that they think Christianity is nefarious. They think it's irrelevant. And so nobody defends it. The case is not made. Right? It's assumed. So it's really important.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, it's been such fun talking to you, Max, and getting to spend some time just reliving, Lewis and the process that has come to be with this film. Now, you've got some screenings throughout November, haven't you, in the USA? What's the best way? CSLewisMovie.com?
Yeah, CSLewisMovie.com. I mean, right now it's only in America, although we just opened up 43 screens in Canada. This is way beyond me. You know, we work with all the movie chains, and but I'm really happy to say tickets are really moving fast, which does mean that if it's moving fast, then the movie chains and those people that be, the powers that be, will open it up to worldwide release after our American release. So I do think that, and particularly because the subject matter is so evergreen, that I do think it's going to have a long life.
Yeah. Well, whenever you're listening to this show, just check at cslewismovie.com and you'll find out what the best ways for where you are to be able to access the film. I mean, does this mean the Fellowship of Performing Arts is moving generally in the direction of movie and video, Max?
I think so. I think so. In fact, Norman and I are reading many, many scripts to look at what's the next film that we want to do. I mean, we're always going to be a theater company. In fact, we have The Great Divorce on stage right now. I mentioned briefly that I'm working on a new script that's a follow-up, because after Lewis's conversion, it wasn't really obvious that he would become the person he became. So sure. What were the steps that led to that? And so the next piece is called Further Up, Further In, which I'm very, very excited about.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, what I was left with at the end of the film was thinking, but we've only just got to the point just before he really takes off now. You know, that there's a whole other story. And obviously others have told parts of that story in Shadowlands and other things. But
right.
But I wait with bated breath to see what you may have in store, Max. Max McLean, thank you so much for being with me on Unbelievable today. It's been such fun catching up. And all the very best as you continue to promote the film. I hope many, many people see it and benefit from it.
Thank you so much, Justin.
It's been great to have you on. Again, if you want to find out more about the film, do just go to the website, cslewismovie.com. I'll make sure there's a link from today's show so that you can find out more about it. And yeah, I highly recommend it. I spent the evening the other night with Lucy watching it, and we both really, really enjoyed it. So go and check it out if you can. We'll come back in a moment for part three of today's show. I'm going to be sitting down with Norman Stone, the director of the new movie.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. No debate for you this week, some conversations on the new C.S. Lewis movie, The Most Reluctant Convert. I'll be introducing the director of the film, Norman Stone, in just a moment's time. If you enjoy today's show, though, do rate and review us. It helps others to see this on podcast, if you can do that. And if you like C.S. Lewis, we think you'll love our other weekly podcast, the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath, who is probably the world's foremost biographer of Lewis. If you want to check that out, they've been doing a great current season with Ruth Jackson on the Narnia stories. CSLewisPodcast.com is the place to go to subscribe to that podcast. Ruth Jackson, the regular host there, but I step in from time to time as well. Coming up later on tonight here on Premier Christian Radio at 8 p.m. on The Profile, the Reverend Carmel Jones, founder of the Pentecostal Credit Union, shares his life story with Uzoma Isakai at 8 p.m. That's on The Profile podcast too. And next week here on Unbelievable, COP26, the UN Climate Change Conference, is about to get underway in Glasgow. Climate activists such as Extinction Rebellion are, of course, gearing up for major activism and protests. It's become one of the most prominent issues of our day. But what does the science behind climate change actually say, and how should Christians respond? That's what we'll be debating next week. I'll be joined to look at the science by Hugh Ross of Reasons to Believe, whose book Weathering Climate Change advocates for a non-alarmist approach to a rise in the Earth's temperature. On the other side is Antonia Godber, a climate activist who believes that humanity is on the brink of a major disaster if drastic action isn't taken. So that's our climate change debate next week on Unbelievable. Right now, let's get into the final part of today's show. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome to the show now Norman Stone, who is director of the new C.S. Lewis movie, The Most Reluctant Convert. Norman, thank you very much for joining me today. Tell us firstly a little bit of your background. How long have you been working in movies, TV, video and so on?
You wouldn't want to know. I joined the BBC in 1975.
Gosh, well,
before that, I'd done films at various film schools and things. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you've obviously worked on, I'm sure, hundreds of projects in that time.
I'm afraid that is true. Yes, but so it seems only yesterday, Justin.
I'm sure. I mean, C.S. Lewis did feature quite early on, because I know that you obviously produced the TV series of Shadowlands, didn't you?
Yes.
How did that all come about?
I'd been working with the religious department as a producer-director from the start for 5 years. I then went freelance, heavens, in 1980. Wanted to do drama more, and that wasn't an easy thing to do within the BBC at that time. But I went freelance with a high hand. I thought, well, right, I had managed to do a drama just before I left. On a blind and deaf Cornish poet called Jack Clemo. I know how to pick him. Actually, it was a wonderful story, and it got awards and things, and I really like filming stories, filming drama in particular. So I thought, well, I need somebody else, because what had worked so well with Jack, him being blind, deaf, and isolated in a Cornish clay pit, was that he earned the right to be heard, basically because he was blind and deaf and true. He was real. An amazing man. When he spoke about God, you listened. He'd been through hell and back, I guess, with his 25 years of blindness and deafness. And I thought, who else has earned their right to be heard? And it wasn't a huge jump to think of C.S. Lewis. So I started to develop it, and initially for ITV. And I came up with a storyline, and I tried to get the whole of Lewis's life into 60 minutes. And I have to say, Lewis's life is wonderful, and you can do that sort of editing if you have to. And it was well received by the people that had commissioned it in ITV. In fact, the only problem was that they had all been sacked, or at least moved sideways by the time I got them this thing. And the script came back. I remember what it looked like, tear stains on it, or maybe that was my imagination. It was quite moving. And they said, this is wonderful, but we can't do it. Sorry. But 3 years later, because these things, when you get onto something like a good story, these things don't go away. They follow you home. Mm. And so the BBC... we're looking for something to do. Now, I'd gone back as a freelance to do Martin Luther Heretic with Jonathan Pryce. Heavens, that's a long time ago, but that's what I'd done. I didn't start that one, but I responded very well to it with Bill Nicholson and David Thompson. And after that was a success, they said, well, what are we going to do next? And basically, I had this film waiting.
Yeah.
It was called then Surprised by Joy. We developed it a bit more and a bit more, and centered on Lewis's life with Joy Davidman and that relationship that was so moving. And it came out as Shadowlands, filmed in 1984, shown in 1985. And that got my first BAFTA.
Yes. And the film that later came out with Anthony Hopkins, was that in any way connected with the TV series, or what?
Well, insofar as this, having instigated the original script and story, although Bill Nicholson did such a wonderful job, we'd all known each other from Everyman in the BBC days when I was employed fully by the BBC. At that point, for 7 years, it was known as Norman Stone's Shadowlands. And then whatever the writing says in the contracts, it stopped. And the original writer, Bill, of this actual screenplay that came out, it became his. And he went and took it to stage first. And it was very moving. It had changed for me the center of the story a little. And that continued when he'd made it into a feature film directed by Dickie Attenborough a few years later. I say change it a little. Don't get me wrong. It was a good script, and the film was a good film, but it wasn't, I didn't believe, truly Lewis.
Right.
It reminded me of a very fine and fancy car where the engine had been removed just a little, because they excised a lot of the faith side of it, I think.
Yeah.
The Christianity, to put it that way, rather than that.
Yes.
And I don't think it was a true picture, but it went on to get lots of Oscars, didn't it?
Beth was indeed. And this is one of my early connections with Lewis was that I actually played the role of Douglas Gresham in a local repertory, play of Shadowlands. And that was actually put on during the time they were filming the film, I seem to remember. So I was probably 11 or 12 at the time. But this has all got great relevance to me, because I remember well those years when I was doing that. But
No, I think that was a strong play. I didn't see your own performance, of course, Justin. My loss.
I'm not sure it's been recorded anywhere, I'm afraid, for posterity. But obviously, you know, you've gone on and directed all kinds of other sort of projects, often with some sort of spiritual dimension to them. And more recently, you again were involved in looking at the works of Lewis. The Narnia Code was a documentary that you did with Michael Ward, a well-known C.S. Lewis scholar. He also features, interestingly, as an actor on the latest project, The Most Reluctant Convert, which really does major on, if you like, the first part of Lewis's adult life, doesn't it? Whereas Shadowlands obviously picks up the story from the point he meets Joy Davidman. Tell us sort of what attracted you to doing this aspect of Lewis's life this time around.
Well, I also did a thing called Beyond Narnia as well in the intervening years, which again tackled most of his life, I think. But that was a drama documentary. When we started working on Shadowlands way back in the BBC days, when they said, yes, we'll do it, and I was freelance, but it came from the BBC, it quickly became obvious, and Bill was great at this, that the heart of that drama, thinking of a story drama, was the relationship with Joy. And that horribly ironic and painful falling, his mother died of cancer. He finally fell in love with this woman. She had cancer. And then she got better when they prayed about it. Good for God. And then she got it again and died. And that is a hugely traumatic and wonderful and uplifting in the end story. That's why we went for that at the BBC Times. Up in this case with C.S. Lewis, The Most Reluctant Convert one, which is basically Surprised by Joy, his own book by that name. Had I thought about it, I'd have probably said, well, let's not do the one we've done before. But it wasn't me. It was Max McLean, who was a friend of mine for some years, a great theatre actor manager in New York for something called the FPA, which is Fellowship Performing Arts. Max is a Christian as well, but does great theatre. The last time I was in New York, he was doing Milton's Paradise Lost, for example, quite interesting, in a packed theatre. So I'd known him for quite some time, as you would be in the arts and with sharing a Christian faith. And he phoned me one night out of the blue, and he was travelling down to some theatre halfway down America, and he was driving, and I think he just got bored. Anyway, he phoned me, hopefully on hands-free, and he said, Norman, do you think this thing will ever stand a chance to get on a screen anywhere? And I said, well, I'd not seen the film. I didn't know about this thing called The Most Reluctant Convert. I said, well, what is it? He said, oh, The Most Reluctant Convert. It's a one-man show I've culled from Lewis's writings. And then I remembered I'd heard about it, but not come across it. So after a bundle of conversations and possibilities, he said, look, will it come on? Will it work on screen? And I said, Max, it all depends on the script. And he said, right, I'll send you it. And I thought, I put the phone down. And I thought, oh, dear, do you really do that with your best friends when they're traveling down to the dark night to a performance? What if it's dreadful, you know? What if it's awful? And he sent it. Sure enough, it was there 2 days later, and I didn't open the package for 2 days. And I thought, ooh. Then I did, and it was wonderful. And much as I love Max, it was wonderful because it was all Lewis's words.
Indeed.
He did a wonderful job stitching them together and making a real drama out of Lewis's own book and books, and indeed other material that Lewis went on record as saying or writing. And I thought, wow, this is great. To cut a long story short, it then came to the point where it clearly couldn't work as a piece of theatre, point a camera, it wouldn't be satisfying. And he said, bless him, well, look, just make it work for film, film or television. We thought it might be on the streamers like Netflix or something. I said, well, it'll take a lot of unpicking and building back again. He said, okay. So he gave me 6 weeks, and I took the filmic eye to it and came out with what you see today. The other important thing to say is that Max, he wouldn't like me saying this, but Max had never appeared on camera in a performance before. Now he's the boss and he found the money. But that wasn't the point, really. He didn't tell me that he hadn't appeared on camera before until he was about to appear on camera. I said, what? And he was brilliant. I mean, apart from the fact he looks like this, I mean, in that film, extraordinarily so. He knew Lewis back to front. Yes. He did so much work on Lewis. He knew the timbre of his voice. He knew everything about him. And we both shared the love for Lewis. We're having worked on Lewis stuff before. So we went gung-ho. And in the middle of the lockdown, which was a strange and difficult time to do it, it cost us thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds just on COVID protection. You took one of those little tests. It cost £247 for one test, I remember. And we were tight on money. But nonetheless, we made it. It worked very satisfactory for everyone who worked on it. I used some very, very good crew. Kenneth Branagh often uses these people, and he wasn't using them at the time. So we went upmarket with that. Craig Armstrong, who did things like Moulin Rouge, the composer did that, and The Great Gatsby and Bridget Jones, all that. He is a local in Glasgow, and I went upmarket with him too. He agreed to do it and did a wonderful job on the music. Suddenly we were making something that really sparkled. And that is what we've been sitting on since earlier in this year, because we wanted it to come out in the autumn rather than the middle of summer.
Well done, because at a time when it was really difficult to produce anything, you got this project, you know, off the ground and filmed and produced in what is, I'm sure in movie terms, a relatively short turnaround, isn't it?
Very. We had 13 days or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, but it looks fantastic. I've had the pleasure of seeing a screen.
Oh, you've seen it.
And it's really well done. And well, you wouldn't know it's Max's first time, honestly, on camera. I guess there is a difference, though, between the way you do theatre acting, which has to be by nature that much bigger than when you're.
It's huge. That is huge. As you will see, if ever you went to see a piece of theatre that put somebody from a television show in it.
Yes.
It's a different projection. It's a different thought. It's a different emphasis on voice. And not many actors can actually do it, in my humble opinion. Jonathan Pryce can. Dame Eileen Atkins can. It's a different approach to translate the character to people sitting at the back of the stalls or someone who's looking close up at you, an inch from your nose on television screen or a film screen. Max has it.
Yes, obviously, it wasn't just Max this time around. You had all those other, well, incarnations of Lewis, the young Lewis, the sort of early student, and then his friends, you know, Hugo Dyson, J.R. Tolkien, and so on. And I mean, just the process of doing that, was that a tricky thing to take it all from being this one man show effectively and creating multiple characters out of it?
Initially, the sixth weeks had it. I mean, we looked at all the I looked at all the options and went through and then brought it back to Max, who wasn't going to be in it. And it was my best moment when he read to page 3 and started on page 4. He says, wait a minute, I want to be in this. I want to do this. And I thought, well, that works. That's good. No, is it difficult? Is it difficult to eat your favorite meal? Well, you may say yes if you've just been at the dentist or something, but it actually is a joy
to
eat your favorite meal. And it felt like that, getting free to be. I produced and directed it, as well as sort of edited it with a chap up here in Scotland, all under COVID, of course. And it was just a joy to be allowed to do it the way you knew it would work. And I think it does work.
Yeah. Well, as I say, I really, really enjoyed it. What are you hoping generally audiences will take away? I mean, I'm sure a lot of Christians who are familiar with Lewis's story will watch and enjoy it. What for others, it may be their first introduction to this side of Lewis, at least if they might be familiar with the Narnia stories or something. What do you hope will be the outcome for those who watch?
You know, I was asked that years ago when Shadowlands came out, and I'll give you the same answer. They said, well, what are you hoping people will take away from this? Well, what do you hope it will achieve? And I said, what I want to do is swing open the library doors. Because Lewis has left such a rich inheritance, foundation of thought, fascinating insights, and a deep and honest Christian faith. We're all flawed, but Lewis put things so well. they can go, anyone who gets interested in Lewis, which you can through a film very quickly, should explore. It's rich pickings out there. And also, in this particular one, which is quite theological and intellectual in places, I hope they see the sense that Lewis was telling us. This is all about how he came to faith from being a rabid atheist. It's not without humor. Lewis was always self-depreciating in his views, and it's highly entertaining. But the actual facts that happened to him, when you look at Lewis and study him, as I've had to do at times, you realize he's being extraordinarily honest. And I think the truth, which he felt he had to, he wouldn't fib or take the money and run. He would do it, even if it was tough and difficult for him as a questioning person in his earlier life. He would step forward to what he could see was truth. And that's not a bad place to be when you're sitting and watching a film.
Absolutely. We're still talking about Lewis over 50 years on from his death, still producing movies about his life. What do you attribute this enduring appeal to?
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? Because he's selling more books every year. At the moment, he's near to a quarter of a billion book sales.
Gosh,
shall I repeat that in case people think I've got a head cold? Quarter of a billion. And he's obviously feeding a hunger or filling a space or taking questions that people have seriously, when it's getting really, really difficult to have deep inner questions answered seriously in this world. You can get, if you disagree with me, you're wrong and you're cancelled and everything can go on. Lewis fills that gap. So why? It's just what I've been saying, I think. He was honest, true, honest till it hurt, true, and yet wonderfully, satisfyingly uplifting insofar as he did get through to God in the time-honored way and explains it better than more or less anybody I've ever met. And it lifts you to the truth of what is there. Why sit in the shadows when you can go out and play in the sunshine? And that's underneath Lewis's own, sometimes tragic, sometimes painful, always glorious, actually, experience.
Yeah. Well, again, I would urge you, if you're listening, to go and check it out. CSLewisMovie.com is the place to go to find out where the showings are currently and what in due course may be a more general release across the world. There's been talk, and I don't know whether there's a sort of movie and TV insider, you have any more info on this, about some sort of Netflix remake of the Narnia series as well. Do you have any info on that, Norman?
I've been told that too by whoever I know in the business. No, haven't they just bought them? I hope they're not doing what they're going to be doing with Lord of the Rings, which is a prequel. Can you imagine a prequel?
I think some people are rather worried about what may happen to Tolkien's genre if it starts to get messed around with too much.
I hope they don't do that with Lewis. Can you imagine Aslan saying, I think we should have a lamppost there? I don't think it's going to work.
Well, we shall see. Anyway, thank you for sort of reinvigorating, really, this and really bringing an aspect of Lewis's life that is so important, yet in a way, I'm sure we'll find a new audience.
Can I just say, I don't think I'm reinvigorating it.
No?
I'm hanging on, got a tiger by the tail and hoping I don't let it slip. I'm hanging on for the ride and it's a great ride.
Well, thank you very much for hanging on anyway. It's been great talking to you. Thank you very much, Norman.
Pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed today's show. You can get in touch by email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. There's also the social media for the show. Now, we've just recently changed our handle over on Facebook. It's now facebook.com/PremierUnbelievable. That's facebook.com/PremierUnbelievable. But that doesn't make any change to the show page. So you can just simply look up Unbelievable on Facebook. That's probably the easiest way to get hold of the show on Facebook. We are going to be launching new social media platforms for the show as well, on other platforms as well soon. You can always get hold of me, though, via my own personal social media, at UnbelievableJB for Twitter. And I'm also on Instagram and TikTok as Justin.Briley. Speaking of social media, over on the Facebook page and my Twitter account recently, I put out a recent article by Premier Christianity. It's titled "Jordan Peterson's Daughter Says She's Found God. Let's Keep Praying for Her." This is the interesting story of Michaela Peterson, daughter of Jordan, who has recently come out saying that she's been praying and reading the Bible, and it's brought her an immense peace, which is an interesting sort of, you know, addition to the story of that family. There's a lot going on in that family, isn't there? So if you want to check that out, again, it is available over on our social media. Thanks for J Metal Blast, who got in touch on Twitter to say, "Once again, I have to talk about how much I enjoy the Unbelievable podcast. Though I remain a committed atheist, my understanding of religious issues and philosophy has really grown thanks to the very interesting discussions that Justin hosts. Highly recommended." Thank you very much, J Metal Blast. Very, very good to hear from you. Thanks also to others who have been in touch. Christine got in touch about the King James Version Bible. This was a show we had recently on one of our classic replays debating King James Version onlyism. Christine says, "I've discovered the world of podcasts within the last year. Enjoy Unbelievable and Ask NT Wright Anything. Listening to the classic replay about the King James Version of the Bible. Personally, I don't read the King James Version because no one talks that way anymore. I get frustrated trying to understand it and quickly reach for a modern English version. Kyle, on numerous occasions on that show, posited that the person in the pew wants to know if the Bible being read is true. I think people are more likely to want to be able to understand what is being read. Also interesting to note is that the year the debate first broadcast was the same year the NIV released its 2011 edition using inclusive language. There was a time when, like James, inclusive language was not important to me, but as I've aged and broadened my understanding of how others think, feel, and find their place in the world, having scriptures in inclusive language does matter. One of the influences in the change in my thinking was doing some theological college study where an inclusive language Bible version, NRSV, was preferred, and we were discouraged from referring to God as He. One of my arguments against putting the King James Version up as the only reliable text is to ask about all the other languages into which the Bible's been translated. Does it mean they're all in error? And what about all the extra scrolls and documents discovered since the first publication of the King James Version? Don't misunderstand me. The KJV put the Bible into the hands of the general population and was revolutionary in its time and has stood the test of time. There are many who continue to enjoy its poetic language, but to say it's the only reliable version is unhelpful to another's personal growth and discipleship." Thank you very much, Christine. You're out in Adelaide, South Australia. And you also want to say thanks for the respectful way interviews between people from polar opposite views are conducted and for being able to bring it back to civility when things get heated. Glad it's been helpful to you, Christine. And thanks for your feedback on that particular classic replay episode. A lot of feedback on our yoga discussion last week. This was Mike Shreve and Chris James, both former yoga practitioners who became Christians, had very interesting stories to tell. And thanks to all those who have emailed their own stories of being involved in yoga in some way or another. Haven't got time for all of them this time round, but I will just bring some of the short interactions that were sent on Facebook and Twitter in response to that show. Lee Jackson on Facebook said, "The yoga podcast is fantastic, Justin. So helpful on so many levels, especially as many of my self-help industry colleagues are very new agey. You're doing a great job." Paul tweeted me, "I don't think a program on yoga and its history and practice would be interesting, but Unbelievable's latest discussion on yoga was extremely interesting and enlightening. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast yet, please do. Well worth your time." Oh, with marketers like this, who needs PR? Thank you, Paul. Brad says, "You can take the physical benefits of yoga exercises while disregarding the spiritual aspects. I exercise every day and use specific stretches that yoga is affiliated with, but you can't hold a patent for a downward dog. The fact the use is connected with yoga is irrelevant." That's Brad's position. Mark says, "Thank you so much for the episode on yoga. As a Christian who has benefited from both yoga and meditation, I needed to hear of potential pitfalls. I also needed Mike Shreve's reminder that the means and end of all Christian spiritual practice is relational. Thanks for those inputs via Twitter, and I will bring some of the longer conversations and responses to the yoga show next week. Just going back as well to our CRT debate, which provoked such a lot of feedback and continues to, actually. CRT and woke Christianity was being debated by Owen Strahan and Jermaine Marshall. Wendy tweeted me, just listen to that excellent debate. I don't see any grace, forgiveness or reconciliation in CRT, and I don't agree that social justice is the heart of the gospel, as Marshall claims. Reconciliation can only be found in a life sold out to Jesus. Art gets in touch by email. Art is a longtime listener of the show, an atheist, I think, out in New York, if memory serves, Art, but says, thanks for the podcast regarding critical race theory. You continue to cement your position as the top Christian podcaster. This atheist puts your podcast at the top of my weekly do not miss list. Glad to hear it, Art. You say, Christians justly point to William Wilberforce as a great example of a Christian fighting against slavery. But I wonder why it took the Holy Spirit 1,800 years before Christians in England recognised that slavery is inconsistent with a commitment to Jesus. What was the religion of those who resisted Wilberforce's reforms? Were they Muslims or Hindus? What religion were those who seceded from the United States over slavery? What religion were those who formed the Southern Baptist Convention because they couldn't remain in fellowship with Northern Baptists who were anti-slavery? Strahan said that critical race theory is based on neo-Marxism, built off an understanding of oppressor and oppressed dynamics pioneered by Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto. A division of people into classes of oppressed and oppressors did not originate with Marx or Engels. The first sermon of Jesus in the Gospel is found in Luke 4:16-19. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as was his custom, he entered the synagogue on the Sabbath and stood up to read. And the scroll of Isaiah the prophet was handed to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free those who are oppressed, to proclaim the favourable year of the Lord." And there ends Art's email. Thank you very much, Art. Appreciate the point you're making. Thanks to all those who have been in touch as well. Many more emails that have been received in the last week regarding the critical race theory debate that took place 2 weeks ago. And we'll see if we get more time for some of them in the feedback section of next week's show. For now, thank you very much for being with me on this week's edition of the programme. Have a good week. Don't forget to check out our show page for more from today's show, more about the C.S. Lewis movie, and indeed to keep in touch with us, our newsletter, Ways to Give, and of course our Confident Christianity course, which you can still get a discount on at the moment. That's all available from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, or with the links to today's show if you're listening via podcast. Let me tell you what's coming up next week. COP26, the UN Climate Change Conference, is about to get underway in Glasgow. And, well, in recent years, climate change has taken on more and more of an apocalyptic kind of language. It's become one of the most prominent issues of our day. But what does the science behind climate change actually say? And how should Christians respond? I'll be joined by Hugh Ross of Reasons to Believe. His book, Weathering Climate Change, advocates for a non-alarmist approach to a rise in the Earth's temperature. On the other side is Antonia Godba, a climate activist who believes that humanity could be on the brink of a major disaster if drastic action isn't taken. That's our climate change debate next week on Unbelievable. See you then.